Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Mags and I'm bringing you 30 minutes packed with the latest South African and global news. We're live right now and then you can catch it later as a podcast. Stay tuned for interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, delivering all the essential updates you need fast and focused. It's Thursday, the 19th of September. On our program today, what the Fed rates decision means for South Africa long term, the rise in the number of global centi-millionaires, the impact of the Bella Bill on homeschooling, and are we falling behind when it comes to the just energy transition race? Now, overnight, the U.S. Federal Reserve cutting interest rates by half a percentage point, kicking off what is expected to be a steady easing of monetary policy. Policymakers see the Fed's benchmark rate falling by another 50 basis points by the end of the year. Now, obviously, attention turns to the South African Central Bank. And joining us, Chief Economist for PwC, Lulu Kruchel, a very warm welcome to you. First of all, as far as the local environment is concerned, what impact do you expect the recent decline in consumer inflation is going to have on the MPC's thinking right now and going forward?
Good afternoon, Jeremy, and thank you for having me on the program. I think it is incredibly important. It shows a signal or gives a clear message to the MPC that interest rates are starting to is starting to lose some steam. So that is incredibly important. But we must remember, although the numbers came in at 4.6%. Sorry, I almost gave us a few extra points off. But came in at 4.6%, and it's almost at the middle of the range. What the MPC is really looking at is what the longer term views are. What does inflation expectations look like? And that will play an important part in their decision. And everything seems to signal at the moment that inflation in South Africa and globally is on a downward trend. It is something that will continue. Maybe we will see small moves from the 1 month to the next. But in general, inflation is definitely seemingly more under control. And even if we look at the short to medium term going forward, that will be important.
Well, that certainly is good news. But Lulu, aside from that, though, where do you think that inflation risk might still remain?
I think probably the biggest challenge for us as South Africa is the value of the rand. Because let's be honest, if you look at what happened over the last couple of years, actually, with inflation, it was to a large extent imported inflation. And then, of course, combined with this, the geopolitical uncertainty and the potential impact that that could have on energy prices, supply, etc. But again, there also seems to be a little bit of light at the end of the tunnel. Globally, energy prices, and not just oil, but energy prices in general, have been under more control. We've seen large parts of the world being able to step up and to fill some of the supply gaps that we've seen. Supply chains have started to normalize. So all of those, positive, but that remains a risk. Anything that could depreciate the rand, anything that could upset global energy supply, and anything that could disrupt global supply chains. That is the big things that remain at the back of our minds.
So, Lulu, at the start of our conversation, I spoke about the Fed and a steady easing of monetary policy. Do you think that as far as the United States of America is concerned, and possibly South Africa going forward, that we're now starting to see a more positive cycle when it comes to an easing of policy?
I definitely do think so. It's been a long time in the making, I suppose. You know, economists have been sitting and looking at these numbers for a while and said the next move for central banks would be to start a cycle of cutting interest rates. So it's very important for us that the Fed has actually taken that decision, because it means that the interest rate differential between the Rand and the US is becoming even bigger. So or smaller, sorry. So the important thing there is that would give us the room to say, okay, but we can decrease interest rates as the Fed does that, because then it shouldn't have an impact or significant impact on the value of the Rand. So very, very important signal that the Fed is sending to the rest of the world. There are some other central banks that have started with the moves to start cutting interest rates, but not the major ones yet.
Now, let's have a look at economic growth going forward. In spite of some improvement, we have seen sluggish economic growth over the past couple of years. If we are moving, Lulu, into a lower interest rate cycle, what immediate impact do you think this is going to have, one, on economic growth, but two, and perhaps more importantly, the ability of business to be more nimble in managing input cost pressures?
Yeah, I think we need to distinguish between some of the shorter term and longer term things that we need to do. And this, I think, is one of those areas, if we see interest rate cuts, that could immediately create a positive short term impact. Now, about 60% of our consumption economy and economic growth consists of consumption, 60% of the GDP. Not all of that consumers, some of that is government, some will be business, etc. But higher interest rates means that whoever is doing that consumption needs to spend their money elsewhere. So for both businesses and consumers, it creates a bit of space, it creates a bit of room. It hopefully also sends a message that we will see a relief of pressure on the consumer down the line. If you're in the business of, if you're a retailer, for example, or anybody that provides services to a consumer, that's going to be positive news to you. And that might also lead to businesses saying that then I can expand, then I can actually grow the business, and they might make those decisions. So on over the shorter term, definitely some positive impacts from that. Over the longer term, hopefully it will have a positive impact on business and consumer confidence. But there are some other things that we still need to figure out. Some of the challenges in the economy, logistics, energy supply seems to be a bit more stable at the moment. And that we will need to continue to work on, even if we see a little bit of a respite from interest rates.
The difficulty, of course, for the central bank is we're a developing economy, and we will still remain in a high interest rate environment. That, of course, Lulu, affects lower income households and small businesses, and that potentially exacerbates inequality and hinders inclusive economic growth, which is a political remit.
That is probably one of the biggest challenges that we sit with in South Africa. Our levels of relative income inequality. There's a stat that always scares me if I think about it, that the UN did some research a couple of years ago, two or so years ago, where they found that it takes nine generations for the lowest income households in South Africa to actually reach that median income level. So it's incredible. And the thing is, what we need to do is look at the factors that are contributing to that. And again, I think we can separate it between long term and short term. Longer term, things like education, things like access to healthcare, things like having a good paying job. Those are all the longer term things. Over the shorter term, again, I think the knock-on effects, the positive knock-on effects that could come from an interest rate cut could eventually reach, you know, the broader parts of the society and allow some space for them, depending if they're an informal economy, maybe. Again, their customers might have a little bit more money to spend. So it will create some space. But again, it's longer term things that we need to do to really change the position for the majority of South Africans.
Thank you very much indeed, Lulu Krugel, Chief Economist at PwC.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, while South Africans have enjoyed a much-needed break from load shedding, the country still is navigating energy difficulties. The Presidential Climate Commission has been using the term just energy transition as we move away from coal towards cleaner energy sources. But what does this mean for the South African workforce in the medium to long term? For example, in the mining sector and also in the small and medium-sized enterprise space, it's critical that people in that sector do not get left behind in what is an important and necessary energy transformation journey. I want to explore all of that in a little more detail with Linda Mabena Olagunju, who is founder and chief executive officer at the DLO Energy Resources Group. And Linda, a very warm welcome to you. So maybe first of all, are we accelerating this just transition process sufficiently, do you think?
Well, Jeremy, as you're aware, the entire globe is on a mission to decarbonize by 2050. And why it becomes very relevant to us as South Africans, we need to start thinking about what happens to the jobs and what happens to the labor force that was previously servicing the hydrocarbon sector. And a lot of people are not really talking about those businesses and those employees that were previously servicing the likes of an Eskom. What happens to them when the country decarbonizes? You need a strategy, a serious strategy around skills and jobs. And it's not just one that operates in a silo. It operates within an ecosystem of many other things happening, meaning you need to build a manufacturing capacity. There needs to be a technology capacity within the country in order to create those jobs. The jobs alone are not going to come from power generation.
And it's a difficult one to balance, given that on the one hand, you've got to deal with the march of progress. On the other hand, though, you have to be empathetic.
Yes, you must. And I mean, we need to think about the word just energy transition. And if you look at the pillars of the just energy transition, it means that communities and the labor force must be taken with. So we all know that, you know, we're facing serious issues around climate change. We do need to change the way we do things. But in doing so, we cannot do so at the expense of people's jobs and livelihoods. So we need to really start being serious about how do we do this. And that's why through the DLO Skills Initiative, we are offering solutions around how labor can be reskilled, but not in a manner only that takes the traditional approach to upskilling. So you're not going to have people leaving their jobs to go sit in another four-year degree or, you know, long programs. We're trying to offer solutions that are quick and fast, but not losing the quality or essence of what needs to be done. So a simple example, we had one lady who operated a window cleaning company. We assisted her in converting that company into a solar panel cleaning company. So things like that that can be done to sort of reskill the labor force in order for them to also be able to take advantage of the opportunities in the green economy.
Why do you think this reskilling debate is not being properly or fairly ventilated?
To be honest, Jeremy, I don't think a lot of people understand the renewable energy value chain. We start there. Like whenever we offer our courses at the DLO Skills Initiative, we start, and when we do the training, we train executives and owners of businesses or even state-owned entities. And you'd be surprised that a number of people don't quite understand what the renewable energy value chain is, because remember, historically, we're a country that has operated our power generation from coal. So we understand the coal sector, but not many people understand the renewable energy sector and how people can plug into the various opportunities there. So people tend to think it's a highly technical field that is only for these very incredibly intelligent engineers. But remember, any power plant relies on support services. You have catering, you have security, you have, you know, your operations and maintenance services. So it's over and above the power generation. There are many ancillary skills and jobs that are required in there. Granted, you do need to sort of upskill yourself to make sure that you comply to what is required for that particular power plant. But it doesn't mean to say that the skills that existed previously become obsolete. It's just a matter of repositioning them to be able to plug and play into the renewable energy sector. But it starts with understanding the value chain.
To what extent is this a policy debate?
I think it is a policy. Well, Yeah, I think it is a policy debate. Although technically on paper, if you look at the Renewable Energy IPP program, there's a lot of emphasis on economic development as well as skills development. But my concern is that most of the spend is going towards early childhood development and scholarships and bursaries for high school learners and university degrees. No one is asking the critical question: what happens to the people that are currently working, running businesses, and servicing the coal sector? How do we make sure that they are adequately engaged in this new green economy? That's the debate at a national level that isn't being had, and that concerns me.
And we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people, are we not?
We are. And the other thing is we need to understand the skills issue more broadly. Again, as I said in the beginning, it's about ecosystems. We tend to focus only on the power generation and how many jobs are created by the power plant. Remember, a lot of jobs, thousands of jobs are created during construction, but those jobs fall away once the plant becomes operational. At a strategic level, we need to start thinking as South Africa Inc. What do we do to create more jobs? A simple example: why aren't we setting up more manufacturing capacity in the country? Why aren't we investing in research and development and creating new technologies for the renewable energy sector? Why aren't we exporting our skills that exist? Because South Africa has a first mover advantage in sub-Saharan Africa in its renewables program. Why aren't we exporting more power within the region through IPPs? These are the things that can create more employment rather than focusing on singular projects that create jobs on an as and when basis, which fall away after some time.
Whether it's companies or unions, do you think there is a real willingness to be skilled?
I see the desire. So in the programs that we run through the DLO Skills Initiative, whenever we've advertised, Jeremy, we've been oversubscribed, to be quite honest. However, the key challenge is funding. There isn't enough funding for these sort of skills programs to make it free or very cheap for the average South African. Remember, South Africans are dealing with a lot of issues around employment and affordability. But if you can take small programs like the solar cleaning program to unemployed youth, you do a lot to change what the future of those people look like, rather than only just investing it in the same things we have been investing it in, sort of CSI projects. I think money could be better spent in real tangible upskilling of people, because there is a shortage of skilled labor within the renewable energy sector. So we're missing highly skilled engineers who we lost through immigration. We're missing these even mid-skilled and semi-technical skilled companies that are black female owned. You know, when tenders come out, some companies struggle to fill those tenders because we're not seeing the visibility of the required demographic applying.
And to that end, and a final question, is there a fear of change or a fear of cost?
It depends on which side. I think that it's both. There's a fear of change. People always fear the unknown. And obviously, people with jobs fear job security. What does this thing in renewable energy mean for me? And the key messaging, which hasn't happened at a national level, is having this discussion to say, renewable energy is going to happen. It is happening. There's no turning back from it. But that doesn't mean that you become obsolete and this is how you can reposition yourself. But the cost element is also a huge discussion that we need to start having, especially around there needs to be allocation for funding for people to be upskilled. In addition to that, there needs to be more spend on by companies themselves on upskilling their labor force.
I am going to leave it there, and as you rightly say, it is an important debate. Linda Mabena Olagunjo, founder and chief executive officer of the DLO Energy Resources Group, thank you so much for your time today.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
With the Basic Education Law Amendment Bill now signed into law, the question, or one of many questions, I guess, is what might this mean for homeschooling and distance learning in South Africa? As a reminder, the so-called Bella Bill seeks to address challenges within the broader education system. There are many provisions, but one is it does regulate home education, and the other one, which has been very contentious, it confirms a ban on corporal punishment. But it's the home education aspect that I am interested in. Louise Schoenwinkel is with us now, MD of OptiHome, which provides learning courses and products to over 300,000 learners per year. Louise, welcome and thank you very much for joining us. How do you anticipate the new regulations will affect the number of families now opting for homeschooling? Is this prohibitive now?
So, Jeremy, the interesting thing that most people don't realize is that the billable and the provisions around homeschooling is very similar to what was included in the home education policy of 2018. So not a lot has changed. I think the big difference is that the billable has had a lot of airtime. There's a lot of fear mongering going on. But if we look at a lot of the provisions, they are too big. Talk a little bit about that. The big changes are the fact that grade R is now compulsory, which if you're a homeschooling parent, that is not necessarily a problem for you. Most of our homeschooling parents do start prepping learners prior to grade one already. And there's also a lot of tools and resources available. So, I mean, if you buy a curriculum like Impact, there will be a grade R set of books that you can use. So that's not necessarily, I think that's an easier challenge to overcome in the homeschooling sector than it is in our traditional school sector. And then the big change is that what's always been included in the home education policy is that a parent that prevents their child from attending school can be sent to prison for up to 6 months. That's a maximum period. And that's been increased to 12 months. But again, a parent who's been homeschooling their children and they can prove they've been doing it and it's at the correct standard shouldn't be fearful of this regulation as it's already in play. I think the department is just a bit more serious about enforcing it now. However, we haven't seen this taken to court yet, so it hasn't been tested. And the bill's very clear on it's a parent who prevents their child from attending school. So the intention here is certainly not to say parents aren't allowed to homeschool. It's to protect those children whose parents are not schooling them at all and ensure that everyone has an equal right to education. Right. I think that's the big point that people are missing is the department is trying to create a standardized environment. I mean, some of the provisions is that you have to follow a curriculum equal to CAPS. That's our national curriculum. You can, of course, follow something else, but you have to prove that your child is at least getting an equal education.
So do you think the regulation, as you've been referring to, of home education under this bill now is going to enhance the credibility and maybe the recognition of homeschooling?
Definitely, Jeremy. I definitely think it will assist with the credibility. Homeschooling is something that's foreign to most people. There's a lot of question marks around the standards of a homeschooler. Are they equal? Have they been equally educated up until now? So definitely, if you just look at the provision around end of phase assessments, for example, again, this has been included in the prior policy. People were just not maybe aware of it. But your end of phase assessments has to be assessed by a competent assessor. So this is grade 3, 6, and 9. Which again, I think this is the department has a good intention here to say, let's ensure these learners are ready for grade 10 and that we're not carrying on and we're not sure by the time they want to write their matric that they've had the exposure they've needed up until now.
So in that respect then, Louise, do you think provincial education departments are prepared enough to handle what might be an expected increase in homeschooling registrations if the landscape is more benign, as you're suggesting?
So it differs from department to department. Some of them are very ready, but what we've seen is, because currently it's also you have to register your child if you are home educating, most of these departments don't have the capacity to deal with the registrations, especially during September, October in the year. So what often happens is that parents never receive feedback. So that is the question mark. I think enforcing the bill also in terms from a capacity perspective will be challenging for the department to do home visits and checking if everyone's done the assessments and they're following the correct curriculum. I don't think our department is set up yet to actually enforce everything.
And just a quick one in conclusion, are there additional administrative responsibilities that parents of homeschoolers are now going to face?
Again, the administrative responsibilities is exactly the same as what it was prior. Parents need to register their children with the department. They need to submit annual results. They need to prove that they're following an equal curriculum. They need to ensure end of phase assessments are done by a competent assessor. It remains the responsibility of the parent to prove all these things and keep record of all these things. So that hasn't changed.
Thank you very much indeed, Louise Schoenwinkel, Managing Director of OptiHome. It's an organization that provides learning courses to around 300,000 learners a year.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And finally, there are currently 29,350 individuals worldwide with so-called liquid investable assets of $100 million or more. That's according to the new Sentai Millionaire Report 2024. It's just been released by wealth and investment migration advisor Henley & Partners and features data from the global wealth intelligence firm New World Wealth. And Andrew Amoyles, head of research at New World Wealth, is with me now. And first of all, Andrew, then, what is behind this increasing trend?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Jeremy. As you say, there's been about a 54% increase in Sentai Millionaire numbers over the last decade, but certain areas, certain countries have performed better than others. So as you mentioned, the US and China, the number of Sentai Millionaires there has doubled. In China, it's more than doubled, mainly because of the really strong growth between the 2013 and 2020. The growth since 2020 in China hasn't been that great, but we're obviously looking at the past decade. So it's including that period when it was doing very well. And the U.S., well, you look at the S&P 500, it's up about 160% over the last decade. So that's obviously had an effect on Sentai Millionaire numbers. The Sentai Millionaire growth hasn't been as high as the S&P 500, probably because of a lot of their holdings on other things. So, for instance, prime property hasn't performed that well over the last decade.
And Europe's cohort in this respect has lagged behind other regions. Is that also a currency argument?
No, Europe is quite interesting because the whole of Europe has far less Sentai Millionaires than the US, which is quite interesting. The number of general millionaires in Europe is not far off the US, but when it comes to the Sentai Millionaires with over $100 million in liquid assets, the US has actually got more than the whole of Europe combined. And a lot of that is because of really poor growth in Europe over the last decade, especially in the big markets like France, the UK, Germany. The number of Sentai Millionaires in the UK has actually dropped over the last decade, whereas in America it's up by 81%. So that's obviously had a massive shift to happen in just the 10-year period.
Andrew, having said that, though, there are smaller European countries, Monaco and Malta, for instance, that are seeing faster growth. I would imagine there is probably a tax link there.
Well, definitely in the case of Malta, definitely in the case of Monaco, there's a tax link. There's obviously no income tax or capital gains tax there, which has always been a big driver. And I think because Monaco is so expensive, it tends to appeal especially to people with over $100 million, because I think people with less than $100 million, they can't buy much in Monaco because it's so expensive. So I think that the growth in Monaco has been quite strong. It's been about 80% in this wealth band over the last decade. And Malta, the growth has been even greater. And Poland as well, it's been over 90% the growth. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. They've had really strong economic growth, and there's been really strong business formation. And some of that in Malta might be linked to taxes, but I think it has more to just do with the fact that it's a really good environment for starting businesses, because the taxes in Malta are not that low.
Just a fun fact here, a couple of years ago, Andrew, I visited Malta, and just a useless piece of information, but apparently they have the highest number of Ferrari sports cars per capita in the world. The interesting thing, though, is you don't see a lot of them on the road because they're all in storage. And who owns them? Well, perhaps that's the conversation, or a conversation we can have at another time. Let's look at cities in the United States of America as far as Sentai Millionaires are concerned. New York, the Bay Area, that's San Francisco, and also Los Angeles. I'm wondering what makes that attractive to Sentai Millionaires, and I would imagine on the West Coast, a lot of that is linked to tech.
Yeah, absolutely. The Bay Area, which is just behind New York City in terms of the Sentai Millionaires, that obviously includes Silicon Valley, so all those places like Palo Alto, Atherton, Hillsborough, where a lot of very wealthy people stay. And obviously, there actually are more billionaires in the Bay Area than New York. But when it comes to the centi millionaires that we're looking at here with 100 million or plus, the New York is still ahead of the Bay Area, mainly because there's still a lot of very wealthy financiers and people in the financial services industry that are based in New York. But the Bay Area is quickly catching up. And then, as you mentioned, Los Angeles is in third. It is a bit behind, but it is, it has also almost 500 centi-millionaires living there.
Before we get on to some of the issues driving the growth in this area, let's continue with the geography and let's get the pain point out of the way. Africa doesn't feature on the list, or does it?
There are some African cities. People can find the report on the Henley and Parker's website, and there is a tab called Cities to Watch. And because we've got the top 50 cities for centi-millionaires, which is the main tab, and then we've got another one called Cities to Watch. And within that, we do mention quite a few African cities, mainly towards the bottom of the list, including Casablanca, Nairobi, Durban, Mhlanga and Belito all together, Lagos, Johannesburg and Cape Town. Cape Town is the top-ranking city in Africa in terms of centi-millionaires. It's home to 28 centi-millionaires. It actually ranks ahead of Johannesburg in terms of centi-millionaires.
Let's talk about reasons now, and I'm interested to know what role entrepreneurship plays in the rise of centi-millionaires globally. Have you done any work in that respect?
Yes, we have. Our research shows that over 60% of centi-millionaires are company founders and essentially entrepreneurs. So that's quite a high ratio, a lot higher than the general millionaires, a lot of which are just high salary positions. So the centi-millionaires tend to be the founders. So, for instance, if you're looking at the S&P 500 or the Fortune 500 or the Nikkei 225, most of the people that started those businesses, if they're still alive, will be either centi-millionaires or billionaires. Although there are only about 400 centi-millionaires in Africa, if you were to take those 400 people away, it would completely destroy the middle class, for instance, because most of the big companies in Africa were started by those centi-millionaires, and if they disappeared, then their companies would obviously downsize, and then it would have a massive spillover effect. Mm. So although there are only, as you mentioned, around 30,000 of them globally and about 400 in Africa, they have a huge impact.
We really enjoy the research that you guys put out. I'm sure we'll talk again in the not-too-distant future. Andrew Amoyles, thank you very much indeed, Head of Research at New World Wealth. We do appreciate your time. And that's our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.